Welcome, everybody. I'm going to call this meeting of the House Interim Committee on Veterans Emergency Preparedness to order. The first thing we'll do is have an organizational meeting to adopt the rules, and I think by this point all the committee members are pretty familiar with the rules, but it's necessary to go through that. So I'll open an organizational meeting and ask for a motion. Mr. Vice Chair.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the House Interim Committee of Veterans and Emergency Preparedness with the rules that we have in front of each member.
Okay. Any discussion of that motion? Any objection to the motion? Not, the rules will be adopted. So then I will close the organizational meeting, and we're going to move into informational meetings. And so we've invited people here today to testify, and I appreciate all of those that have come. And so the intent here is more of a dialogue than just a one-way street. Obviously, in recent months, there's been a lot of national interest in what's going on and what may or may not be happening in Oregon. And we certainly, over the years of developing the resiliency plan and that and working with, a lot of awareness of a lot that has to be done. And one of my concerns early on was is to hear more, especially those on the coast and that, more about where things are, to try to have a larger conversation about the role of the state and where we can help and strategize from a priority standpoint to make sure that those that are the most at risk to start with, and then we move our direction out. So part of my intent in setting this up was just to kind of hear kind of the state, what you're doing, where some of the gaps are, so we can have conversations in going forward about the roles and how we can complement or support those efforts. Obviously, we all know that there's a lot to do. And no amount of money in the near term is going to solve it necessarily, but my concern is just the prioritization so that we get the most out of what we are doing to address those needs. And so so I hope everybody will be comfortable. Just come up and we'll have a conversation. You can present where you're kind of at in that, but I hope the members here are just comfortable, can ask questions in that and make sure we understand those things. So we have no prescribed order necessarily, but I'll just go down the list of people who are comfortable with that, because we have Seaside School District, Columbia County, Tillamook. We have three seats. So Doug Doherty, Doherty. She told me that too. Tom Hyde from Columbia County. Is Tom here? And if more people, sure, come right ahead. Thank you. Because we know, so school districts, that's a great way to start off, because in many cases some of the information we heard late last year as we had hearings in that was some of the issues that the school districts would face. And obviously the legislature took some action late in the session as far as regarding bonds or funds potentially available to help address that. This is kind of a great way to kick this off.
Thank you.
So welcome. And if you just identify yourself for the record and we'll begin the conversation.
Go ahead. What school district?
I'm Doug Doherty, superintendent of Seaside School District.
Hi, I'm Commissioner Hyde from Columbia County.
And Mark Labhart, and I have the privilege of being a Tillamook County Commissioner.
Very good. So who wants to, we want to talk about schools first, or go with the counties?
Okay, I have like 5 minutes to sort of give you an overview.
No, that would be, absolutely, that's what we want. So help us understand where you're at.
Thank you. First off, I really appreciate the, speaking on behalf, I also serve on OSPAC as a commissioner. I appreciate the money that was put in for retrofitting and for capital improvements. The problem is the Seaside School District cannot qualify for any of that because we're in the tsunami inundation zone. There are four schools in Oregon currently that are in the tsunami inundation zone. Mm-hmm. Seaside has three of those schools. What I'd like to do is give you a few personal insights. This is my 34th year working for Seaside School District, my 24th year as an administrator, and 18th year superintendent, and my 24th year trying to relocate our schools.
Okay, thank you.
The piece that's important to understand is the three schools that are in the tsunami inundation zone are less than 15 feet in elevation. And you all know that DAGAMI, in their literature, talks about that the typical wave heights for Cascadia event will be between 20 and 65 feet at the shoreline and as high as 100 feet. For the last two decades, I've been asking help from everyone, from state legislators to U.S. representatives, U.S. senators, and FEMA. And at the end of the day, I was always told there is no money to help us, to assist us with relocating our schools. And I've tried everything. As a first-year principal at Cannon Beach Elementary School in 1992, I started evacuation drills. What ended up happening is I found out from National Geographic, who did some research, they came and filmed us. At that time, we were filmed doing our evacuation drills because we were the only school on the West Coast that were doing them. It became apparent that we needed to move our schools about that same time. And in discussions with Dagami, I found out that the Senate Bill 379 line was not based on science. And so I paid Dagami to conduct a research study and to core drill to identify past Cascadia inundation zone levels that occurred over the past 10,000 years in our area. This study doubled the elevation of what was previously assumed and changed the evacuation zones for all towns along the Oregon coast. I hired geotech engineers to study and drill to identify the best possible new site for our schools. I hired engineers to design foundations with base isolators to allow our community to have an immediately occupiable building for a long-term shelter. I helped the LCD understand what would happen during early on. They had no idea what would happen during a Cascadia event, so I spoke with them at great lengths over several years. I worked with our community so that they understood the condition of our outdated schools and the increasing cost of maintenance. And we hired a Northwest campaign firm to poll our community regarding the opinions for our bond. And at that time, 70% of our community members said that they would support it. After all this careful planning, the bond did not pass. No district in Oregon has had to move all of its schools at once. The cost is prohibitive for a small community with poverty rate well over 50%. We also have a large number of residents who are retired and on a fixed income. We learned during our campaign that several things occurred and that, you know, we have some very large apartment owners. They threatened their hundreds of tenants with much higher rent if the bond passed. I still have their flyers. And what was interesting is we have two-thirds of our people who own property in our school district do not live there. They're second homes. We had a very large number change their residence so that they could vote from their second home. It's not legal. It occurred. And that was one of the pieces. I've spoken with large campaign strategists, state lobbyists, people from ODE, OSBA, and COSA, and none of them can think of anything else we can do. I'm really exhausted from jolting awake in a cold sweat at night thinking about what happens in our school district. Engineers tell me that each of our schools has a high chance of catastrophic collapse in a Cascadia event where the building will just crumble on top of the students. We know that even though they're doing their duck cover and hold drills like they've been trained, take a minute to think about what it will be like on our coast with an 8.8 to 9.2 earthquake, what it'll feel like, what it'll do to our schools, what the children will experience during the 3 to 6 minutes of carnage, what it'll sound like, what the students will see if they survive. 15 to 20 minutes later, the tsunami arrives. It's anticipated that it'll be well above most buildings in Seaside, and it'll last for several hours. We have many interior classrooms. Those classrooms, those doors will jam because the earthquake will move the foundation. And because, for security reasons, those doors are closed, they will jam, they will not be able to get out of those, the tsunami will come, and the students will drown that way. If the students can evacuate the schools, the high school has to evacuate 1.3 miles over a bridge, hoping that bridge is passable. We have an elementary school, Gerhardt Elementary School, that their evacuation, the highest they can get is 45 feet, and hope that the Cascadia tsunami is less than what it average is. I need you to know about the conversations that I've had with teachers, administrators, and classified staff who are planning to stay with the children who are trapped. And they cannot escape, knowing that they too will die in the tsunami. The clock is ticking, and we can't keep acting like we have unlimited time with this and that other people are going to take care of it. For 24 years, I've done everything I can possibly think about to relocate our schools, and I need your help. And I do believe that the state has a moral and an ethical obligation to directly intervene on behalf of our children when they are unsafe, and truly they are unsafe. Thank you.
So let me just commend you for the years of efforts that you've put into this, because I understand the frustration and anybody's attention in all the years, but you're to be commended for staying the course and presenting the information and trying to get somebody's attention, and that's part of what this discussion is about, is to get at the point you don't have to do it all by yourself, that we figure out, again, this priority and how we make that happen. But the question I have, and I apologize that I'm supposed to know this, but I don't. I don't understand how you don't qualify for any of the funds.
Thank you. The Oregon Constitution does not allow a school that's in the tsunami inundation zone to be retrofitted. It does not. The funding formula for the matching funds, mm-hmm. There is a formula. And because of the property values of second homes in our area, we are at the bottom of the list of all 197 school districts.
Representative Evans, please.
Under that same challenges to the way it was written, I believe there's also a clause that there are limitations on how and what you can do with the money, including demolition. So if you wanted mm-hmm. to trade land and perhaps try to use the market value of the land in some type of effort to get cheaper land, you can't invest any of those dollars in that process as well.
Is correct. And the other piece is in working with the LCD, once we leave our current properties, mm-hmm. the zoning will need to change, and we will not be able to really get much money from those properties at all. Right. Thank you.
Other questions from members of the committee? Representative Escobar?
Yeah, you made a statement that the LCDC didn't understand.
Yes.
What's to understand?
What the Cascadia event is going to do. What basically understanding what is going to happen during the earthquake around the state of Oregon, and that the damage will cause loss of infrastructure and tax base to be able to rebuild in areas that are currently zoned in certain ways. And DLCD is the group that oversees the zoning. And so helping them understand that, for instance, a school district that has three schools in the tsunami inundation zone, we will not be able to sell that property the way it's currently zoned, and helping them sort of process all of this for all the towns that are in Oregon.
The issues are complex.
Show them a video of Japan.
This was prior to all of that I had those discussions with them.
But we heard before we adjourned, I mean, we had some conversations, and we heard some about the land use issues and just being able, the way the land use issues are written, find sites that you could go move the schools, let alone those.
And so at that urban growth boundary.
Yeah, exactly. That growth boundary. So, and I appreciate you bringing that up, because some of the conversations I've had this summer with some of the people doing the studies, and that's an issue we've talked about. So how do we start, especially the time it takes us sometimes to address changes to our land use, how do we get the urgency we need to get there to start addressing some of those? But I appreciate, again, you mentioning that, because that is an important factor that's going to be taken care of, too.
Thank you.
Other questions for, again, thank you very much. That was very informative. I appreciate your efforts.
I think I'm going to go next.
Okay, again, absolutely.
Again, it's my heart, privilege of being a Tillamook County Commissioner. I have no way I can possibly, I wish the TV cameras were here to hear the superintendent's comments, because people need to hear that. I'm going to cover four things with you today. I'm going to talk about the current situation that we have in Tillamook County, and I think the rest of the Oregon coast, with problems that we're having with coastal erosion and what that means to earthquakes and tsunamis. I'm going to talk to you about what Tillamook County is doing about land use rules. Mm-hmm. We've implemented some brand new land use rules that LCDC is looking at, a template for the rest of the Oregon coast. I want to talk to you about what we're doing volunteer-wise with some of our coastal communities and volunteer, and then I want to talk to you about the partnership that we have with other counties when the disaster hits. So I'm going to try to cover that all in about 10 minutes. I know I'm speaking to the choir and a lot of this, but you should have a handout there. This is a little community of Neskowan. This is actually one of the coastal storms that we have, but you can picture an earthquake and tsunami. That's a motel right there. Neskowan is a little small community in southern Tillamook County, about 200 full-time residents, and a lot more in the summer. It goes up to several thousand people. This is right on the beach. This is what happens after the waves come in, piles up stuff all over the place, runs up into cafes, and there's a bridge around the other side of this. This is actually not a tsunami event. This is actually a flood event for the only access in and out of Neskowan. And when I testified before you in May of this last year, I think I showed you this slide. But just think of that as the beginning of a tsunami event coming into the little community of Neskowan. It's going to wipe that bridge out. Most of the population lives over in this area over here. Almost all of the population of Neskowan lives there. Elderly folks, grandchildren on vacation, those kind of things. So that bridge is gone. Here's some of the current coastal erosion that you see in and around the Neskowan area. So that's fine. What are you going to do about it? This is another one up called the Capes up in the Tillamook area near Oceanside, Oregon. Governor Hatfield had a place up here. Coastal erosion right in this area here. These are very expensive condominiums right on the ocean front dropping in. Lawns drop vertically 18 inches. The DGAMI report experienced landslides with an El Nino event. Houses at risk. Some of the houses got lettered and couldn't be redeveloped. But as you get a large tsunami event or earthquake event, a lot of these are going to fall into the ocean. Some property owners are spending what I call really big bucks. This is $500,000 fix just to protect one house in the Neskowan area. This is erosion. Here's some riprap that's being placed. Here's riprap here that's being placed. All legal, all okay, but big bucks to try to protect their coastal front property.
And so that's on their property, is that the idea?
That's on their property, and they do have permission from state parks to go down and do that.
Do that work.
And I'm sure you're familiar with, there's certain parts of the beach where you can riprap and certain parts where you can't, and these were qualified under to be able to do that. It's starting to get a little of attention, the Salem Statesman, coastal towns rethink erosion. This is pretty interesting because when you do your riprap, and you get high tides, you can't even walk around the beaches, and that's happening in many places along the Oregon coast right now. So we all saw the New Yorker article, the earthquake. Well, I might want to tell you, I also served on the governor's task force for implementation of the resilience plan, so I'm pretty familiar with what's in the resilience plan. So here's, we all know, we have a 30% chance of a 9.0 in the next 50 years. You know that already. We know that Japan, here's before, here's after. We know that we're going to have wastewater systems fail. We know we're going to have electrical systems, liquid fuel systems. The liquid fuel site in Portland's going to be toast. Road systems are going to fail. We have lots of bridges. We know that. Ports are going to be damaged. Cannon Beach, this is the 1964, where the bridge was located down here, and now it's in pieces up above there. It's happened before with coastal erosion, the community of Bay Ocean, back in 1912, beautiful little town out on the Bay Ocean Spit, west of Tillamook. Ocean erosion, 59 homes, a motel, all went back into the sea. And so it's happened before without a tsunami and earthquake. So this is the estimate of what's going to happen in Oregon and Washington. We've got 296 miles of coastline. We've got 3.4 million population. The population is exposed directly to a tsunami is about 22,000. Residential buildings damaged 453,000. Short-term housing requirements 523,000 people. Short-term pet sheltering, don't forget about your pets, 315. Mass feeding, hydration, over 1 million people. Deaths, roughly estimate 4,226. Injuries, 15,000. Most of us are going to survive. Most of us will survive the earthquake and tsunami. It's the disaster after the disaster that's going to get us. Let's pray to the Lord that it's in the summertime when the Seaside School District is not in session, or the Rockaway Beach or other school districts up and down the coast. Building debris, tremendous amount of building debris. Okay, so I made my point. So we know it's going to be bad. We know it's a disaster of all disasters, probably for the United States. It's going to make Katrina look like a cakewalk, I believe. We know we're going to be on our own for a while, so what are you doing about it? Okay, so we've got the Oregon Resilience Plan, which you are all very familiar with. We need to work together. That's the key, is working together with our federal partners, our state partners, local partners, city, school districts. We need to work together. And we can't be just say, well, the state's got to bail us out. State's got to bail us out. We got to work as a county with you. We've got to work as cities with you. We've got to work with the federal government with you. And we've got to work on this thing together, because we're not going to fund it all. We know we're not going to do that. So we've got to work together to implement this thing. So I thought this was a really good quote by Dr. Goldfinger, who's, if you don't know him, you should know him. He's a certified smart guy from my standpoint. Ultimately, zoning decisions and decisions about what risk class a building would fall under in the buildings building and tsunami code are local decisions. These folks have life and death decisions to make, and they need to know that this is the case, and they need help to do the right thing. In other words, land use is done at the local level. You set the big picture, and then land use is done at the local level. So we know we're going to have a bad situation. And we've got property all along the coastal strip that people want to develop in, or that they're currently have, or they want to remodel, or those kind of things. So do we shut our eyes? Do we say, well, go ahead and do it? No, we need to start thinking the long term here about making the tough decisions as local elected officials about development along the Oregon coast. So what are we doing about it? The little community of Neskowin took the leadership role, and they came up and said, we want to address coastal erosion issues in the community of Neskowin, and we also want to think about an earthquake and tsunami scenario. And so we met for 3 years, monthly meetings for 3 years. I talked to you about this when I talked to you in May. We developed this Neskowin Coastal Adaptation Plan. We've implemented some of the provisions derived from a 3-year community effort called the Neskowin Coastal Erosion Adaptation Plan. While it specifically deals with coastal erosion, many of the provisions could apply to future development along the Oregon coast. So what does the ordinance do? The OCD is considering using this ordinance as a template for the rest of the Oregon coast. We as elected officials need not only deal with our day-to-day issues, but look to the future, and we know what the future holds for our coastline. We know that we're going to have problems in the future. I'm just going to really quickly go through some of this because we don't have time to talk about it, but it requires a certified engineering geologist certified things, requires a structural setbacks, it limits density, requires that any land division, at least 1,500 square feet building pad, be provided outside of the tsunami inundation zone, requires movable structure in the zone. In other words, it requires you, if you're getting coastal erosion, that you're going to have to move your house back. Requires that a certified engineering geologist certify the development with an acceptable level. Does this cost more? You bet. Did we get a lot of blowback on it? You bet. Blowback enough where they went to LUBA, and LUBA upheld us. So this is law. Now, provides guidance for minimal disturbance of lot development, allows the staff discretion to contract out peer review and reports. So nearly every bullet that I just talked about can be translated into tsunami planning along the Oregon coast. So it needs to be made clear that the tsunami inundation area is much larger and higher in elevation than the Neskowin Coastal Hazard Zone, and more work is needed. So we need to address that more. So here's Seaside. The school district is where, right in here? Is that?
That's, yeah, approximately, yeah, right in there.
So here's Rockaway Beach, too. This is the blue line that you see as a tsunami inundation zone. So Seaside's toast. Rockaway Beach is toast. Pacific City. I mean, just go up and down the entire Oregon coast. So what else are you going to do about this? We've developed these sister county relationships. We've developed 5 sister county relationships where we've entered into agreements with counties, other counties, and we meet annually with the respective board of commissioners to talk about what we can do. We've developed memorandums of understanding. We commit to yearly resource estimates to sustain this relationship. We are looking to find and obtain resources to sustain the relationship, and annually the official, and this is PUD, is the Public Works Director, we signed mutual aid agreements. I'm going through this fast just to. So counties that are currently interested right now that I know of, and I'm pretty sure Columbia County is going to be on that list here shortly.
It is on that list.
These are the counties that are currently interested in participating in this relationship. So I want to go back. So what we've done is Tillamook County's entered an agreement with Umatilla County. Umatilla County is going to provide public works staff, public works resources when Tillamook County gets hit. We're going to be, our public works staff is going to be working 24 hours a day, and they can only do that so long. We need to bring over their staff. We need to bring over their equipment that we can get there, but mainly we need staffing to fly in helicopters and help relieve some of our resources so we can get roads back open to critical resources like hospitals, those kind of things. So DLCD has also prepared some guidance to assist local governments in becoming more resilient. You should be very familiar with that if you're not. It's land use guidance that focuses on three areas: life and safety of adequate tsunami evacuation facilities, zoning limit uses, encourages some community facilities uses to be located out of harm's way, and then incentives, provides options to provide land use incentives to develop in a more resilient way. So then back to the third point I wanted to make about the volunteer efforts. We've got this emergency volunteer corps in the Halen. They are an amazing group of individuals. And James Roddy, who used to be the Earth Sciences Information Officer for Dogami, said this: the Emergency Volunteer Corps of Nehalem Bay is a deeply committed corps of like-minded volunteers that have forged a remarkable private-public coalition in three small coastal towns, Manzanita, Nehalem, and Wheeler, which is one of the most visionary, innovative, and organized local emergency preparedness groups in the United States. They started from nothing. They now have 100 trained community emergency response team members, or CERTs, 160 team CERTs, 133 Map Your Neighborhood captains, co-captains, 42 American Red Cross volunteers, 54 ham radio operators. Hams is going to be what we're going to, that's the only thing that's going to be left are ham radios. All the other systems are going to be down. We have a medical reserve corps, which is retired doctors, retired nurses, and they're in place right now. It's funded by the cities of Manzanita, Nehalem, Wheeler, Nehalem Bay Fire and Rescue, and it's got partnerships with all those other groups. They've got an infrastructure emergency plan. They have leadership through the community, and now it's filtered out into other parts of Tillamook County, and they can be a template for the rest of the Oregon coast to talk about how do you get volunteers organized in counties that aren't organized right now. And I think that's it. And instead of saying the end, it's probably not the end.
So one of the key questions, and I appreciate all the information that we're spending, but one of the key questions becomes sustainability. So these are great efforts.
Yep.
And obviously the counties and people are absorbing whatever the costs are now to try to get this going. But the key thing is we don't know when the event's going to be. And so how do we sustain all of this that's going to be critical to the response, and especially the volunteer in that, to the point at which when the event is there, we can respond?
Yes, Chair Lively, that's a very good point. You're only as good as the volunteers and their commitment to be there at that point in time.
At that point.
What the Nehalem group has is they've got a whole series of adults, retired folks, and then they went all the way down to school children. And so these school children are learning that they can be volunteers too. So we're hoping that as some of the older generation says, well, I just can't do this anymore. I appreciate volunteering, but I'm burnt out. Some of those others, the younger generation will step up. But you're right. It is difficult to sustain a long-term program.
Captain Escobar?
You're correct, I believe, about the ham radio operators are going to be your focal point for your communication when the infrastructure's gone. Every year in my community, they have a trial run. Mm-hmm. And they go out in their vehicles and they do set up portable stations throughout the community. I highly recommend that if they don't do that there. I assume they do, though.
Chair Lively, yes, sir. They do. In our county, we have practices when we invite the county commissioners out to do a little talking on the radio. So, yes, in our county, they do that.
Well, they don't go that far in my county.
I might also say in closing, unless you have other questions, We, Tillamook County, and I think other counties have an extremely effective, good relationship with the State Office of Emergency Management.
Okay.
They are a key partner and a key player in all this, and I wish they weren't here so they didn't hear me blowing smoke on them, but I would say that whether they're here or not. They're a key player in all of this, and that is a partner that, if it wasn't for them, we wouldn't be where we are in a lot of places where we are. So can't say enough thank you for their efforts.
Other questions? So any other key area you've identified, and not the Department of Emergency Management, but from the state standpoint, and again, I appreciate all the efforts that are going on, especially along the coast, to get ready. But part of what I'm trying to get to, what I heard from the school district, so what are still some impediments, in spite of your money you're spending and the leadership and stuff, what are those impediments that at the state level we might be able to talk about to address to help ease that? I know it's going to cost more money as time goes on, but...
Chair Lively, there's one point my emergency management director wanted me to make. There's $300 million that the legislature has allocated for retrofitting schools.
Mm-hmm.
We need to have and I don't know if this can happen in 16 or 15, 17, but we need to have some more dollars allocated to training and getting the word out to not only the volunteers, but the citizens of our state. And it's not just along the coastal strip. It's in the Willamette Valley, too, the TV stations are doing a pretty good job right now and the great shakeout and all those kind of things, but we need to get the word out to people in these communities about how do you prepare, how do you have your kit ready, what to do in the event of a tsunami, what to do in the event that you're on your own for probably literally weeks, and start getting more training out to do that. And that's going to take some funding. So he would highly recommend that you also consider that.
Great.
Chair Lively, I have one quick, if you
Absolutely.
Have a second. I have one other quick thing that might be helpful to school districts, and that is that right now there are no teeth in the law to move schools out of the tsunami inundation zone. In working with Dagami, the decision actually goes back to the local building inspectors of whether or not they would allow a school to be built in the exact same place that it is.
Seriously.
I brought together the Cannon Beach Seaside and Gerhardt City managers and their building inspectors 12, 15 years ago, no, it's longer than that, and asked them, the way that you interpret the law and what you know, would you allow me to rebuild the schools right where they are? And to a person, they said yes. Nobody wants to be the bad person that causes a school to have to be relocated, possibly out of their community.
Thank you. That's a great point. Yes, sir.
Well, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, again, Commissioner Hyde from Columbia County. And I'll give you a short background. First of all, I was mayor of Vernonia in the flood of 96, which really got me going in trial by fire and emergency management. So I've been a member of the Oregon Emergency Management Association for 20 years. I sat on FEMA's Oversight Commission. I helped form a regional disaster preparedness organization, which is Clackamas, Multnomah, Washington, Columbia, and Clark County in Washington State, of which I'm president of. We have our own Homeland Security Emergency Management Commission in our county, which is a compilation of cities, fire departments, some businesses, and all the other practitioners in the county. Frankly, because emergency management as we know it today, it really falls to one turnstile, and that's the county commissioners. And quite frankly, with the exception of Mr. Labhart here and myself, there's not a whole lot of knowledge about emergency management. And frankly, I worry about what happens to that system when I go away. So we formed a commission that's made up of practitioners that frankly run emergency management in our county, and they help fund it. Because the training is the key. And after we had 9/11, we had a whole new system where people were able to talk to each other if they were trained up. Lots of requirements came to all of the cities and the fire districts, special districts. So by forming together a commission and paying into that, we gained capacity to do all of these things. And that's the continuity question that you ask. That's how we keep this thing alive. And then finally, we can move down to the LEPSI, which is our Local Emergency Planning Commission, which is basically the industries and their alert system. And we work with them as well. So we're all coalesced in this system that starts with the community and then emanates out into the county and then truly into the region. Everything I just discussed is connected at the hip with the state. And I will echo what Mark said. We can't say enough good about OEM and how we're connected. My only issue with OEM is that there's seven layers between the manager of OEM and the governor, and that's really not right. All right. It should be maybe one layer at the most. So, isn't disparaging. I'm just saying the system is set up right now. Emergency management is not at the top of the list, and it certainly should be. And we're not just talking about the tsunami, although I'm really glad that this has drawn the attention. It's drawn the attention to the system, not the tsunami. And we have floods and fires and weather events all the time. Not to mention the other big kahuna that nobody talks about, the super volcano. And if you haven't studied up on that, you'll lose some sleep. I recommend that you get on American Public Broadcasting and watch that 1 hour. That will cause you many hours of sleep loss, because that's another one that's going to affect our community when that happens. And it's not something that may happen, it's something that will happen at some point, hopefully not in our lifetime or our kids' lifetime. So I have two points. Clearly, I think that Columbia County and Tillamook County are probably the most prepared today of any counties in the state of Oregon. And it's mostly because we've had the issues. Mm-hmm. We've had a lot of presidentially declared disasters, and it's either get on board or get swept away. We learned from the 96 flood, we had this 350 to 500 year event, so we're good. So let's just rebuild and we're going to be great. We rebuilt in place. I actually ask, and this is a point that I would like to you to remember, is I ask as a mayor of a small community that's been inundated, DLCD, along with a grant that we got for, I don't remember, $100,000 or so, to change our comp plan to really encourage growth in the higher parts of our community. And after a year, an expenditure of somewhere between $60,000 and $100,000, we were told unequivocally by the state, you have too many buildable lands in your inventory, therefore you cannot expand your urban growth boundary. We spent the next decade encouraging growth in the flood zone and then lost $100 million in damage in our community. And clearly we have had, there's one complete school system that has been moved. And that's in Vernonia. And we did have to move the entire school system, K-12.
$40 million.
I'm sorry?
$40 million.
$44 million.
Really?
So it can be done, but it needs the collective push from the state and the community and the federal government to make that happen. I think Seaside is clearly our case.
Four times as big.
Yeah, clearly the case that we need to push together. Mm-hmm. So there are two pieces. There are things we can do as a state in inner departments. And I think that we need to take a good look at Senate Bill 100 and how that affects our ability to do that. And secondly, I think that we need to make sure that we continue to encourage our local communities through the counties to keep our emergency management system robust, whether it be in Eastern Oregon or on along the coast. And frankly, that's an issue. I equate it to the same thing as a family that's running on a very tight budget, and there's tough months, and they come up to, do I make a house payment? Do I make a car payment? Do I pay for groceries, or do I make that insurance payment? Well, you can guess which one of those is last. Mm-hmm. And that's what emergency management is. That's the insurance payment. And if you need that insurance and you didn't make that payment, it's already too late. If you, for example, rammed your car into somebody else's, it's too late. And that's I've seen that happen in this state with emergencies. And we, frankly, don't have the capacity that we should have. So I think that we need to, one, make sure that we have that backbone of emergency management support. That we now, I think that from my perspective, the backbone of emergency management in this state is the EMPG grants. And that's what gives the counties that really aren't that interested in it at least some play in the game, and it's got requirements that are very stringent about planning, tabletop exercises, etc., if you do receive those grants, and it also requires you to match that money. So I believe that is the backbone, and I by no means am insinuating that the state is trying to take the EMPG money. I do think that collectively all the states need to push back to the federal government and say, you know, that money has been stagnant for a very long time, and if we're talking about ramping up the emergency management system, we should talk about emergency management backbone and how that needs to be ramped up as well. So that's my first piece. The second one is I do think there are things we can do with different departments in terms of encouraging marks right on money. It's very difficult to tell people that you can't build here with your valuable land because at some point you may be in danger. That's a dollars and cents thing that hits very hard on our entrepreneurs. And I think we have to have the gumption to do that, both from flood, tsunami, fire, all of those things. And it takes land use laws to make that happen. So I think we need to work together on this issue. I do think we need to look more substantively on how we do our comp plans, because sometimes the Senate Bill 100 rules just get in the way. We haven't upgraded those since, what, 72? I think it's time that we look at those with this lens.
Representative Evans, please.
Thank you, panel, for being here. Offline, I have a lot of different questions for ideas. However, for today, I'm going to put you guys on the spot to volunteer other people. Got to love that. One of the bills that
Mr.
we did not have time to get to during the last session was a requirement for elected and appointed officials, local government, similar to a bill that or a law that Texas has in place, that a certain percentage of the community elected officials need to have gone through emergency management training prior to getting certain types of grants. And that was the carrot and the stick to get more people aware, because in many cases, to your point, unless you have had to look through that lens, it's never generally on top of the list of things when you have to worry about school class sizes or environmental issues or all the other things that elected leaders have to live with. That said, once you study it and realize the risk to your public, it generally never leaves you. So my question is this: would you folks, either individually or through organizations that you're interested in, be open to that type of requirement, to at least, to your point of when you leave, who's going to know what to do, keep that level of education and awareness?
If I may, Mr. Chair and Representative Evans, let me give you an example. This is the one that I carry around with me. It's so glaring. The city of Vernonia flooded in 96. I'm a resident there. They flooded again in 07. In 09, we had a very close call. Water was coming up. Folks were very, very nervous. And as you may or may not know, if you're going to get any kind of help, in particular from the state and then from the federal government, you have to declare an emergency. And that declaration has to be developed by the city council, voted on, and then it's moved over to the county, and the county does the same declaration and sends it off to OEM and the governor. So this is a town that's flooded twice in a little over a decade. 2 years later, they're very nervous. The water's coming up. It's looking like they're going to flood again. I called the mayor and said, have you done a disaster declaration? And she said, well, no. How do you do that? Mm-hmm. How do you do that was the question. So I asked them, I explained it to them. They had an emergency council meeting. I sat in my house waiting for the call. Finally, at 12:30 at night, I called and woke the mayor up and said, did you declare a disaster? And she said, yeah, we did. I said, did you send it to anybody? Well, no. We didn't know we had to send it to somebody. So that's how quickly.
No, I'm going to take that as a yes.
Yeah.
Just that fast. And I mean, okay. It's funny, but it's really not.
No,
funny.
It's not. But it's indicative.
And it's just indicative of local government. Look, they're wonderful people all, and they're volunteers. But I agree with you. I think that if we have ICS 100 through 300 mandatory requirement for elected officials that run communities, It's not that hard. It's a day, maybe three if you're really interested. But I agree. I think that that is, should be a rudimentary knowledge that everybody that runs government should have, period.
So, Chair Lively.
Yes.
Representative Evans, I'm a type 1 incident commander, so you're singing to the choir. I'm also an area commander. There's only like five of us in the nation that are qualified in area command, so I'm pretty well there already. If the bill didn't pass, there was probably some reason for it to not pass. I don't know why. But maybe there's an opportunity. I'll only speak for the counties, but we have every year, or every 2 years, I think it is, we have what we call county college. And we encourage, and most new county commissioners attend county college. It's about a year program, and they go for several days at a time. And maybe we could get OEM tied in with, instead of just taking a tour of OEM, which they do, of having, yeah, like, okay, we're going to have a class that day where you're going to get, you know, the 100 class, the introductions class, so that those new county commissioners can get up to speed, at least start that process, and then bring back the bill in 16 or 15, 17 and see if it's got any legs. But I think we can do that, and that doesn't take any kind of, I mean, it would take, Tony and I both sit on AOC's board, so we can help push for something like that to say, okay, we're going to have a class, and we would ask new county commissioners to attend that, because sooner or later, you know, you say, well, I don't have any disasters. Well, talk to Grant County, you know, the Canyon Creek Fire. They had a huge disaster, and a lot of counties, doesn't matter whether it's fire, flood, wind, whatever, you're going to have a disaster in your county at some time in the future. And those county commissioners, and maybe AOC, LOC, the League of Oregon Cities, has something similar, I don't know. But then we can start with that. So.
Yeah.
I'll talk to you later about it then.
Representative Escobar, did you have a...
Yeah, so thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple things. First of all, I was very pleased that Representative Evans didn't want to do a task force.
he didn't say that exactly.
That was a great idea.
Write that committee bill.
Write that committee bill. Okay.
The train whistle. And
Commissioner, I think you brought up a very good point when you said maybe we should reevaluate and look, well, you didn't say reevaluate, but look back on Senate Bill 100 and what the intent was. I think that's what you're getting at. And I think that Senate Bill 100 was probably substantially different than it is mutated into today, the interpretation of it, because you have people making administrative rules. And the reason I say that is because I was on, I think, she was the administrator on land use when we had former Governor Atiyah came in, who was on the original task force on that, one of your task force. He was on the original committee, and he said something very striking. He said, it's land conservation and development. He said, we forgot about the development but continued with the conservation. Mm-hmm. And that stuck with me forever when he said that, because he was there when we crafted that thing. And what he was saying was, this has gone completely different than our original intent. So I think that's a very valid point, and thank you for it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Escobar, I would say one thing that I do think we have a tool in our pouch right now that we could use in terms of working towards some good land use decisions, and that's our regional solutions teams, mm-hmm. where we have state agencies aligned in our region to push for some any kind of substantive projects that we're looking at. And some of the projects I know in our region are directly related to preparation. So given the constraints we have today with Senate Bill 100, I think we have a way to work within those. But I would reiterate that Senate Bill 100 needs a look.
Go ahead. In my area, we had, you probably heard about it, everybody laughed about it in the state. We had our two-year regional problem solving where we were going to get together and do the zoning with all the cities. I think 14 years later, we finally achieved that.
Yeah.
It had 12 or 14 years, but I was on the city council when we started it. I went to the Senate, I came to the House. I think they've just completed that here in the last few years. But, I mean, it was just amazingly large undertaking to get that many entities and that many people with different agendas to agree upon something. So
I think we have an opportunity because of the attention and focus upon the potentials of what would happen and whether the large fires that we had this year, but of being prepared to have a discussion. And I appreciate your comments about Senate Bill 100. What I know is what a political quagmire that is. But we need to do something. And what you started to point out is some key areas that hopefully within the existing, that whether it's rules or otherwise, we can start the whole idea about being able to move the schools and the value of the land you're at, or the land that we have that they just held you to rebuild there because that's where the land says to do it. So I think there's some of those that we want to work with you to identify to see if we can start chipping away. And the key thing, of course, becomes time. Mm-hmm. Because it could take, as you just described, years, as I know it does at times, but we don't really have years at this point necessarily, nor do we want to spend the years. We want to start addressing these things. So part of what I would hope we can do is work to identify some of those things that we can start incrementally maybe. And the coast is a place, if we can make it work, ought to be the place we make it work, because that's the priority. That's exactly right. So the other issue is the volunteer. So one of the things we talked about last time, we had a couple bills that dealt with especially volunteer firefighters and that, and the whole ability to keep volunteer firefighters, keep them equipped in that. And I assume in many cases, majority all the firefighters in those districts are volunteers.
Not all.
Most of them,
sir.
But the bulk.
And so part of, again, and we had some bills talking about some tax credits or other ways, because they talked about the expense of equipment in many cases, the fact that they're volunteers and doing their, so how we can kind of go back and make sure we understand what that whole network is and where there's more risk because they're volunteers in that, and what role the state can play, to me, again, is another one of those areas I'd like to look at and see if we can work towards some solutions, since we started a little of those conversations last time but didn't get very far. But I think that's some of the things you pointed out.
I couldn't agree more, Mr. Chair. The amount of training and time it takes for a volunteer fire or EMS, that they have to spend away from their family to be available for all of us, is astounding. And I agree that if we could figure out some way of giving them a credit for that, it would help with us in terms of continuity of operations.
Great. Thank you. Any other questions?
There's one thing that came out from these gentlemen was the inflexibility of the system.
Sure.
That really stuck in my mind of what you were saying. You're saying that common sense, we're overriding common sense with rules. Is that what you were saying?
Exactly what I was saying.
Just wanted to get that for the record, Commissioner.
We appreciate your time. And again, thank you.
Thank you very
this
much.
Has been very informational. Informative, and I look forward to continued work on some of these things and at least identify some pieces we can start addressing, and certainly in Seaside with the schools. I mean, we're in this together. We got to figure that out.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Okay, so Mayor Toledo, Billy Joe Smith? Not okay. How about City Administrator for Gold Beach?
She's here.
Okay, and Jonathan Wright, City Manager of Reedsport. Good. How about Jenny Damaris, Emergency Manager from Lincoln County? I thought at the badge net you might have something to do with emergency management.
I do.
Okay.
Oh, I have lots to do.
I thought she was going to give you a ticket or something there.
Okay. Again, thank you. Thank you all for being here. So whoever wants to identify themselves and just provide some overview on that, where you're at and what your issues are, I would appreciate that.
Okay, my name is Jody Fritz. I'm the city administrator for the city of Gold Beach. I'm assuming the reason why I'm here is the OPB story that's going to air tomorrow, because I hadn't been invited up here before, so it just seemed kind of coincidental.
But you can come anytime you want. Feel free. But you don't have to be invited, but I appreciate that you
can. Yeah, but okay. I figured that's why I was here. So on your agenda that was sent to me, the question was disaster preparedness challenges in smaller coastal communities. Now, if we're just talking about emergency preparedness, I feel like actually my city is way more prepared than bigger cities because we're used to micro disasters pretty much every year. In the time that I've lived in Gold Beach, I've lived there since 1979. The only way in and out of Gold Beach is through Highway 101. And so just in my, 30-some years of being there, The road is slid out at least four times. One time, both north and south. Usually it's one or the other, but in 2005, it was north and south. So the people in my community are very disaster conscious. We're self-sufficient. We know how to take care of ourselves. So as far as an emergency happening, I feel like we're much better prepared. But I have a feeling that's not what we were wanting to talk about. You're wanting to talk about my hospital. And so I will give you just a brief history on that. The hospital in Gold Beach was first built in the early 1950s. As you can imagine, there wasn't any building code at that time. It's been added on to since then. It's a small hospital. There's only like 15 beds. We have an ER. But in 2013, the state fire marshal, we get a waiver. We've gotten a waiver for a lot of years to the state fire life safety codes, just because the building can't be retrofit. I mean, it's just, that's the way it is. But in 2013, the fire marshal said, we can't do that anymore. So by June of 2016, unless you guys can retrofit the building, we're going to have to shut you down. So that's the only hospital in my entire county. So it's a publicly owned hospital. It's not owned by, like, Providence or Peace Health or whatever. It's owned by the citizens. And as you can imagine, Curry County is, if we're not the most depressed coastal county, we're pretty darn close. So the hospital district went to the citizens. We voted to approve a bond to rebuild our hospital. And there was two different considerations at the time. That first off, we didn't have a very long timeline. You know, we had, you know, the clock was ticking. And the second part was, we don't have a lot of money. And so the decision was made that we would put the hospital right exactly where it was. It's going up now, after much grief and heartache. But it's right next to the existing hospital. And when our new hospital is completed, the other one, I think they'll probably keep portions of it for administrative, but it won't be used as a hospital anymore. So there was a lot of questions on the outside about, you know, why would you build a hospital in the tsunami zone? And the frustration for us locally has been, we're not building one in the tsunami zone. We are replacing one that is being closed by another state agency. And so the frustration for smaller communities like ours is that it doesn't matter if it's the state fire marshal's office or the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries or DLCD. It's the state of Oregon. The state of Oregon is closing our hospital. I don't care what agency it is. But then when you have another agency come in and call our community unsophisticated, we don't know, we need help on these things. You know, I'm a land use planner by trade, and so obviously I know a lot about coastal erosion, I know a lot about coastal hazards, and I know specifically about our community. And so I would agree with the House Bill 100, because when, I think it was 2 years ago at the Coastal Planners meeting, you know, DLCD trotted out there, you know, lovely, this is how we develop in tsunami zone plans. Aren't we all so happy about this? Yay. And so I raised my hand and I said, okay, but what I want to know is the holy resource land, you know, the holiness of that, is that going to be lessened so that in communities like mine, where I'm surrounded by resource land, so where are we going to put these things? And basically the answer was crickets. So If we're going to be getting new regulations that says that further prohibits development in areas that is already prohibited, there has to be some give and take. And I would agree with what you said about Governor Attia, that it's land conservation and development. It's not just we have to conserve everything, but we also have to put things where they should be appropriately placed. Mm-hmm. And my frustration was that people from the outside were saying, well, you have these hills around you, you know, you should go up in a tsunami. Okay, well, sounds good on paper, but some information that I brought for you, and I'm not going to go through the slides, but information that I brought for you is that the reason why Gold Beach is not built on those hills is because those are landslides. And when I have somebody from Salem come to tell me in my town that, well, no, the landslides aren't that bad here. It's like, okay, well, as a city official, we clean up a lot of landslide debris, so I'm not sure what your level of is not bad, but I know what mine is. and certainly not locating a hospital in an area where we can't, you're going to have ambulances running up a hill after this earthquake? I mean, that's not going to happen. So my frustration is that I think there's a lot of good intention, but I don't think the people think about the consequences of their good intentions, that these are real people's lives that are being affected. And I'm going to say the dirty word here, but it's about money, too. I mean, when you're talking about limiting development in coastal areas for towns like mine, those are the most expensive properties in my town. So are we going to have a Measure 37 claim now because we're going to restrict development in those areas? And I'm not saying that that's what I want or don't want. I'm just saying that these are the conversations that need to be had, which aren't being had. So I'm just about done. I'll turn it over to them. But one of my city councilors came and talked to the governor's office, I believe last month, and she wanted to come up with me but was not able to attend. So she asked if I would read a letter that she had prepared, and you all have copies of it as well. Dear Veterans and Emergency Preparedness Committee members, after having several discussions over the past several years and after attending the Coastal Caucus where a large panel of experts spoke, it's clear to me that local input is critical to any state-driven plan for resiliency. If the state just took the advice of the university-driven information, then coastal communities would have the unintended consequences of negative growth. Ghost towns would become the coastal landscape with dilapidated buildings peppering the area. I say this because it was their suggestion that the state require a geologist certification that it would be safe to build on a site. The challenge is that the statement sounds benevolent and well thought out. Unfortunately, it's actually just the opposite. Now, geologists will tell you where it's safer or would be better, but they're not going to certify that it's safe. They don't do that. Geologists do not certify anything is safe. Unfortunately, most of the reports that I've read over the years have multiple disclosures to reduce liability, that this report is, in reality, an educated guess of what's there and gives an engineer a basic idea of how to build around any hazards. Asking for a certification, in effect, would stop building. A better solution to the resiliency plan would be to have the state provide each community with planning grants to incorporate the new information on earthquake and tsunami hazards into long-term community plans. The question to be answered is, and she wrote 5 years, but I think she meant 50. In 50 years, where should essential public facilities be built? When schools are ready to be built, where is the best area to build those? A 50-year plan to include adding buildable land where the public facilities could eventually move to would be a great way to forward that resiliency goal. And that's where we have to decide with, you know, do we want to protect the resource lands of the state, or do we want to have an area that's developable but that's less subject to disaster? Because those are two totally different discussions, but absolutely related. For example, in my city, we're built on a river delta. I know you all know where Gold Beach is. we're where the Rogue River comes out to the ocean. So we have the second largest river in the state, in probably one of the smallest towns. But so my whole town is built basically on delta sand. We have more planning goals to include in our normal planning already, because we're on the coast. With additional state funding, we could hire the right consultants to find the lowest risk areas for future locations. We actually have an oceanfront high school that would probably be best constructed eventually inland. The key is for communities to assess the numerous risks and make decisions based on all of the facets, not just narrow the scope to the two potential hazards. And that's where every year we have flooding and landslides every year. We have forest fires occasionally, but, you know, in the realm of how often does it happen, you know, obviously earthquakes and tsunamis are not as prevalent, but there's also other disasters that happen on a frequent and almost timed basis that we have to consider. We cannot control or predict Mother Nature. In reality, humans are still not great at predicting the weather, so predicting when the next volcano will blow is not, in reality, an accurate hypothesis. But we all know change is inevitable, and planning for hazards is good government policy. Please take the time to consider any unintended consequences before making decisions on what will be required of coastal communities. Economically, we are still struggling. Curry County still has one of the highest unemployment rates in the state, and we do not need more regulations that slow our economic growth in the short run. And that would be my only that I'd like to end with. Please don't give us unfunded mandates. Please, please, please.
one of the hardest part of this discussions is understanding the concept of the mini disasters and that, because depending on where you live, and like us that live in the valley, we're not necessarily a subject to those things. And so while I appreciate and understand what it is, and it's absolutely you as the communities have to always deal with it, it's a harder conversation where a lot of the population is, where in many cases we're immune from that. I mean, we built dams and things, we just don't have them. But you have them all, and I appreciate you saying you have them all the time. So that's the other thing you deal with besides the longer term,
yeah,
trying to plan for that. So
I think that's why it's frustrating when people say we don't understand the
right.
risk of where we live. It's like, okay, first off, don't be patronizing to me, but second off, we absolutely understand the risk of where we live. And
sure.
I think that sometimes people in the larger cities think that, and I mean no disrespect, but I think sometimes people that live in the larger cities think that us rural folks are country mice, and that if we were truly educated people, we would want to live in urban areas because that's where people want to live. Well, the people that live in rural areas, I live there just because it takes me 3 hours to get anywhere, and I had to get up. I'm shaking not because I'm afraid, but because I am so amped out on caffeine. I was brushing my hair in the bathroom. I thought, they're going to think I'm totally nervous. It's like, no, I'm just wired. Because it's a five-hour drive up here for us. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we deal with natural disasters all the time, where I don't think in the bigger cities you guys get to experience them as often or as, you know. To us, it's like, Hunter Creek's flooding. You know, don't go the other way home. I mean, that's something that happens virtually every year. So,
thank you. Sure. No, thank you very much for driving and coming up here. Okay.
Jonathan Wright, City of Reedsport. I would like to just dovetail in a little bit on what Jody was saying. This is one of the things that we have experienced recently in trying to switch the paradigm of the public in looking at risks. Most people that move to a coastal community value their access to coastal water bodies. Yeah. I mean, that is a social benefit of being in a coastal community. We are geographically restricted in many cases based on the topography of our area into being able to provide service to higher elevations, much less, Jody brought up another good point, is based on the geology of most of our landforms, some of those areas are not equipped to be developed, you know, much less have roads or utilities running through them. So it is a very difficult situation for coastal communities to be in. You know, the rules that get passed down many times seem to be geared towards protection, obviously, number one. But really, the enforcement of those, you know, falls back on us. And then the political backlash or the community backlash is that it's us making this decision for them, and it's bad policy because they've assumed those risks. They came here knowing that they were going to be along a water body. So that was all I had to say. City of Reedsport, very unique. Actually, I'm very humbled to be here. The gentleman that spoke before us, obviously infinite amount of wisdom, background information. My background's planning, 10 years now, and city manager of Reedsport now. My anniversary will be in October, so of 3 years. So fairly new, feeling my way through this. I'm here to give you a report of a unique opportunity. I'm sorry, Jody, that the city of Reedsport has. We are one of the qualifying communities in the HUD National Disaster Competition. A little background, we are a coastal community. We are on the third largest estuary in the coast of Oregon. And we are surrounded, or at the confluence of the Umpqua, Schofield, and Smith Rivers. We have been next to the water for many years and have, as a community, learned to adapt to the things that have occurred there. So 1964, this is actually a picture of our downtown. There's the shopkeeper out there. He's waiting for the water to go back down so we can broom the water out and restock the lower shelves. After the 1964 flood, we contracted with the Army Corps of Engineers to install a levee around our downtown area. One of the unique challenges of running a city, well, running a city is a unique challenge in and of itself. You always have challenges with water, wastewater, those types of things, but we also have a levee, good for us, which is 50 years old. So the levee protects the majority of the downtown core. That downtown core consists of both federal, state, and local government administrative buildings for the county and city, as well as most of the utility or the equipment that would be necessary to fight a disaster or to recover from a disaster should one occur. This is also the only area, and I'm going to say that I'm here speaking for Reedsport, but I'm actually speaking for Coastal Douglas County, because what we are doing here would, in essence, hopefully support many of the folks in the outlying areas. We have the only food distribution networks in this area. We also have the only fuel distribution networks in this area. Makes it a unique challenge. Plus, we have two state facilities that run right through the middle, Highway 101, Highway 38, including our historic Old Town, which, of course, you know, historic preservation is a big part of land use and heritage. So we did have two qualifying events. You know, we get natural disasters that occur. Good for us. It qualified us for some money. This was in 2011, 2012. We received, and this is, we actually, it's interesting to look at the modeling of rainfall. We actually have hard data on rainfall, and over the years, while we get less rain during certain times, the intensity of the rain that we do get is significantly higher. The intensity of those rains have started to overwhelm the capacity of our drainage system inside the levee. Most of the residents call it fondly the dam levee, because it works great to keep water in as well as keeping water out. This is actually the back parking lot of City Hall. It's very hard to see. You can see the sandbags up by the back door here. That's common. All up and down our 101 and 38 corridors. We actually, because we can't afford to fix most of these issues, we actually issue sandbags every winter. It's beautiful to see those things up and down our major corridors there. And it really entices people to want to invest in our community. When you walk into a business and you're confronted by the water line from the regular flooding events, on the floor, it is slowly undermined and degraded our community as a whole. What that does is two things. One, you have the health issues with the structures that are inundated. Two, you have the fact that now your assessed value of your properties is going down because nobody's fixing them, because this thing continues to occur. The other thing is our historic downtown started to look like a historic, what do you want to call it, apartment complex community, because what was once commercial properties, ideally located by the waterfront there, because nobody wants to have a actual storefront, has now turned into low-cost rent rental apartments. Mm-hmm. And so what was once street displays for businesses is now barbecues and lounge chairs, despite our land use code, which is hard to enforce, as most people know, going mm-hmm. after folks like that. So midterm impacts from this is property values decreased, rents were reduced to try to promote people to come in, and yet all we get is people that want to live in there. The long-term impacts of flooding obviously are the structural issues. Those things that may not be totally present to the eye, but after you inundate a building a couple times, the rot, the structural failures, and the saturation of the soil as it expands and then contracts causes these significant issues. And on and on and on. So the one on the right there is actually, I call it the House of Mystery. It's hard to tell in the picture, but it's leaning. It's kind of, I wonder if their toilet like flushes.
See it on the roof line.
Or maybe they pour water, it goes uphill. It's very strange. So we, luckily enough, are in a competition for $1 billion. The minimum award is $1 million. The maximum award is $500 million. I say we, because this is the state of Oregon, it's the city of Reedsport, and the city of Brookings. So we are preparing our strategy right now for resilience. This is something that, when we're talking about preparedness, we talk about grab and go. We talk about, you know, the ICS training classes. We talk about, you know, getting city council together during an event so that we can declare disasters and so forth, and how we're going to react to those things. But we really don't talk long term, and that's really what resiliency is about. And this was kind of a paradigm shift for me, because I came into this going, I need to fix a levee and some drainage problems, and I came out of it going, we have a bunch of stuff to work on. This is some of the criteria that got us in here. I'm sorry, this was actually designed, I reproduced the slideshow from before. We did a windshield survey. We identified 100 homes that have been damaged by floodwaters. The estimated cost of damage is over $6 million. These are the areas that traditionally flood, the buildings that were identified and impacted. This gentleman, people are very forthcoming. When you're walking up and down the road with a clipboard, first of all, they want to know what you're doing and why you're in their neighborhood. When you explain you're there to try to figure out a solution for them, they start volunteering all kinds of things. This gentleman actually has the pipe down there, and he's aware it floods. Many people are desensitized to this. It floods, it inundates the whole underside of his house, and then when it goes back down, he has this pump system that he uses to evacuate the water. As a result, his house on this side and the one on the neighboring side have actually settled towards each other. It's very strange. He also brought us inside to show us the back bedroom, which he no longer uses because he's got it duct taped off so that the mold doesn't enter the rest of the house. Another one was looking at the bottom side of a house in this same neighborhood. The lady wanted to show me where the traditional high water mark is on her foundation, which you can clearly see there. This was during a not significant event. This is what normally happens in certain parts of our community now during heavy rains. This gentleman joked that, you know, he just buys boots now. He doesn't even buy shoes because there's no need for it at his house. You can see in the background the 1970 Zero pump station. It is a single drive pump. It is driven by electricity, which is struck to the grid. There is no backup for these things, and I'll go into that in a minute. We also had a number of affidavits from property owners. As you start calling people and going, so what kind of type of impacts have you had? Well, let me tell you. Okay, well, then here, we need to document this. Also, the U.S. Forest Service, who's in our community, tells us, if you can't fix this stuff, we're going to leave. So that was 39 jobs that they said is going out of the area, and federal jobs are good jobs in our community. Environmental things, you know, non-point storm pollution, most people are involved. Interesting thing here is that the average household income in Reedsport is $33,710, which is 33% lower than the national average. 80% of the people earn less than the normal income. Unemployment is much higher, 1.55% over the average. I'm going to just breeze through these. These are damaged properties. Here, this shows the sandbags in the downtown that are present throughout the winter. These are HUD's goals, which kind of really got us thinking about this resilience thing and what exactly resilience is. And so here we are today. We are working with the state to create the Rural ROI, or the Rural Resilience Oregon Incubator, or Return on Investment. Reedsport and Brookings have a unique opportunity right now. We're going to take advantage of that opportunity, and the outcome of that we would like to be able to share. The state wants us to share it, and we want to be able to share it. We want to be able to go to other communities and say, this is the BCA that we did, this is how we did it, these are the outcomes and the damages that could occur. These are the solutions that we have worked. These are the challenges that we faced, and these are the expected outcomes. And hopefully you could do this faster and better than we did. Here's the setup for the Rural ROI. It deals with communities. Ultimately, it'd be stored in a knowledge bank. Regional Solutions and DLCD DLCD are the ones that are playing major role players in this. The Reedsport approach is the holistic approach of we're addressing current issues, future threats, and recovery. Now, recovery becomes that whole very complex story. What we're doing for immediate recovery is we're proposing to replace the 1970 Zero pump stations with concrete, seismically engineered pump stations that can evacuate a whole lot more water. The biggest one that we have in town is a 90-horse pump, and that thing runs a lot. Right now, the power goes out, and that's it. The water just starts backing up until the power comes back on. So these are going to be plumbed with 200-horse pumps that will be plumbed independently. So if one goes out for whatever reason, the second one's there as backup, plus internal power generation facility for each one. So they can actually operate independently. We have a significant event or the levees overtop, say, during a seismic event or riverine event. It'll continue to work even after people have left the whole area. We're also providing large detention ponds. These also work for biological treatment, if anybody knows anything about the green stuff. Help settle out the metals. Also, balances temperatures before discharging it into the river. We're also upsizing much of the collection system. I'm trying to get through this pretty fast. We're also planning on elevating the levee. The levee protects that whole downtown core. Currently, it barely meets the 100-year standards. We're looking to take it up to the 500-year standard. That puts 3 feet on top of the existing level, which also accounts for subsidence during an earthquake event. Also deals with sea level rise, which we are one of the first communities on the coast that FEMA is paying for to have a sea level rise analysis done as part of this, because if we're going to put shovel to ground, we want to make sure that everything we're doing is done wise and with future expectations. Another major hurdle here is replacing the Schofield Bridge. Nice thing is it's not a huge bridge, but it is a lifeline between the downtown and the uptown. During a significant Cascadia event, we have no way to evacuate people out of the downtown. They can go to high ground, but as for the injured, the people that we have to stabilize or get to medical attention, they have no way of getting, because this bridge will be gone. This is a picture of the bridge underside. It is actually pier on span, and this is held together by gravity. It's a novel concept. Well, because we don't have earthquakes. In 1940s, that wasn't a thought. This has been a great bridge. I mean, it's held up till this point, but obviously not thinking about the future. So what we're proposing is a model bridge that not only takes into account seismic engineering, but also is going to take into account hydraulic modeling that the city's pairing with FEMA to pay for to address tsunami loading during an event. So we're going to be one of the first communities with a demonstration bridge that's actually designed to address the elements of the Pacific Coast. Also, we are proposing a water reservoir. Most people, you know, think, well, if we put seismic valves on our water tanks, that when it starts shaking, that's going to save the water. Well, most of us have concrete, if not very old metal tanks, that most likely won't withstand a 9-point-something. So what we're proposing is a very large 3.5 million gallon tank to be situated in a part of Reedsport in which we are looking at a planning strategy to relocate a number of folks from the downtown. So we have this long-term goal of let's take people out of harm's way. Of course, you have to kind of convince people of the value of moving out. But let's put a tank up there that now provides service. At the same time, it also provides redundancy of systems and provides a water source through the hospital, which would be through a hard line. The resolution's a little off, but this hard line goes directly to the hospital. It has flexible connections that are made to withstand seismic movement. And then also to the Western Douglas Command Center down here, where there will be a fireman, there will be a police officer, somebody there to actually distribute water to the community. 3.5 million gallons, even at some loss, is enough to operate the community or to distribute to the community to fully operate the hospital, as well as giving 3 gallons per person to everybody in that region for 3.5 months. It's also made with chlorine residual in there, so we don't have to worry about it going bad on us. It'll actually have a chlorinator that'll activate and be operated by a generator. One of the other things is the housing assistance program. Remember, holistic approach. We're trying to figure out what we do with the people that have been impacted. There's the House of Mystery, again, is working with a nonprofit to actually set up HUD housing areas that aren't going to be government-owned. They're going to be nonprofit-operated, but will actually be part of a plan to provide home ownership to folks. So these people that own homes downtown could have the opportunity, depending on income and a few other hurdles, to own a property uptown. So we're actually going to be helping folks move from one place to another, not just saying, hey, you guys have to get out, actually working with the folks, the low, moderate-income folks, to get them to high ground. Also working on small business revitalization. We want to talk about resilience. Part of this planning effort is how do we engineer a community to be more resilient? You're not going to take the downtown away. We realize that. It's just not going to happen. So what we're going to do is we're going to re-engineer the downtown as developments occur. So as new developments occur, there'll be regulations like wet flood proofing and so forth that will play into development plans. Part of this will be starting with these structures and working on them to be wet flood proof or have some type of flood proof measurements put into them through either grant or loan program that'll be operated by the city. I know that was longer than I said it was going to be.
That's all right. That was fascinating information. Yes.
I'm just curious on your backup generators. Are those diesel or are they propane?
Those are diesel.
Okay. Now diesel deteriorates in 12 to 18 months.
Yeah.
What's the plan on that one?
The generators will be operated regularly, like most of the generators in town. We have diesel generators throughout town. Those get exercised and run for a certain period of time monthly. How you stabilize the fuels, while it'd be cycled in, the long-term goal for fuel is that the hospital has a giant reservoir underneath it that they use to operate most of their facilities. In fact, they use it to operate their vehicles, so it constantly gets renewed up there. We would tap them for refills as things are needed.
Any other questions?
Yeah, you have to turn that over.
This is in the pre-planning stages. Right now we have diesel generator scope there. That'll be something to consider, though.
Well, propane, you don't have to turn it over.
We don't have propane reserves in our area. We would be going to barbecues to try to get the propane.
They'll get a whole bunch bring of in 5 gallons and yeah. give them water.
So we did look at that, and there is maybe an opportunity for, because it does have such a long tank life, is to actually purchase one and then stage it somewhere. But then we'd also have to be able to transport that or collect it and transport it via boat or however we're going to get out to these things to continue to dewater the downtown. So it's not an easy situation, no matter how you look at it.
And what's the timing on either you're in or you're out from a standpoint of the grant?
October 27th is the filing deadline. If anybody would like to participate, October 5th at 10 a.m., there's going to be a public hearing held somewhere in this building where people can provide public input to it. They tell us the end of this year, first part of January, we will know who the finalists are. We're the finalists.
Oh, okay.
We already went through phase one. That was all that information that we gave out to qualify. We started out with quite a few communities. The economic component of the people that are impacted, you had to declare a disaster and show that these certain people are impacted. That's a huge challenge for a lot of people.
You bet.
Which kicked a lot of them out and left some of us, good and bad, in to get this far. We're very hopeful that they're going to see the structure is there and fund the whole project. Brookings has a number of great projects also. Gary's not here. I can't really speak to his projects, but we're hopeful that they're going to look at this as one of the first steps to actually hardening a rural community, because during this event, rural communities are going to be by themselves. Mm-hmm. The bridges are going to go. We're going to have a great deal of landslides. We are going to be isolated, and that's really what we're planning for, is the ultimate event and being able to save maximum lives and then sustain ourselves while we recover.
Very good. Well, good luck with that.
Thank you.
We hope you are too soon. So, okay.
Hi. Good afternoon. My name is Jenny Damaris. I am the Lincoln County Emergency Manager. And a little bit about my background might be helpful. I actually came from the healthcare industry, not a clinical person, but healthcare safety and emergency management. Been all over the place, and I think there's value to that, to some of the comments that have been made by the other individuals. I'm also a volunteer firefighter from one of those smaller districts that you talked about. Currently on a leave of absence because the young lady in the back and my regular job takes so much time, I can't give. But the comments that you made about the volunteers and paying for their equipment and being able to volunteer, we can see in our own county that they aren't able to recruit up again because they're like, ooh, we lost our points. There's no incentive anymore for us to give all of that time. So just put that aside there. Good work is being done. So out of all the things that you've heard today, I, in my position, get to have the benefit of direct contact with the end user of all of the planning that you see and talk about today. In my job, I get to talk with the citizens, the access and functional needs individuals that don't know how to evacuate from the South Beach community because they have an elderly mother and a developmentally disabled son, and it takes them 15 minutes to get out of the house on a good day. So my job is very challenging in my county because I do have small coastal communities who do not have a paid emergency manager. The city of Lincoln City, bless their hearts, have been able to maintain a half-time individual to help with that. The city of Newport is just now being able to designate full man hours to be able to do that. But Yahat, Siletz, Toledo, the rest of them, those are all other duties as assigned to a fire chief, a law enforcement chief, maybe sometimes public works or a volunteer group. So the county emergency manager tends to pick up the slack and try and help with that messaging. And some of the things I want to point out to you that I think would be beneficial on a larger scale, not just for smaller coastal communities, but all of the communities in Oregon. And then also I had an opportunity to talk with some of my peers, which are represented by the individuals that are here. Those other county emergency managers I count as very close friends and peers, and we talk a lot about what we can do more with less. So one of the first things is thinking about outreach. It is the cost of doing business. We have to provide materials. In our EMPG grant funding, we had suggested that perhaps coastal communities or those with different hazards be included differently in the funding formula because we have a high tourism population. However, it was noted that the larger metropolitan areas also has a tourism industry, but theirs are 365. They're always there. They have access to more resources. Our population comes in and hoards for a specific period of time. They don't come with their go kits. They're there on vacation. They're not packing their American Red Cross for the five kids and grandma that they brought with them. So that leaves us at a disadvantage that our financial population is supposed to pick up the difference for this migratory population that comes in during a disaster and event. The other problem that I have or challenge that I face is what brochure do I give them and how do I pay for them? So for example, tsunami and earthquakes being the most prevalent media discussion, there's four brochures as a county emergency manager that I could provide to citizens or visitors. So here's one from the National Weather Service. It's pretty great, glossy, probably cost a lot. You actually have to pay for those. You get one or two free packs, and after that, you got to pay for them when you order them. Here's an older one that's probably still in production through the state, Portland General Electric, Oregon State University, the Sea Grant. Here's one from the Department of Geology and Minerals. Mm-hmm. And I'm getting to a point. Oregon Tsunami, this is part, I can see Deputy Director Sucky, he knows me, he's back there giggling. He's waiting on pins and needles to know what I'm going to say. So this is done by the Department of Geology and Minerals during that big production that we did with all those amazing glossy maps to get the people to evacuate. Okay, so there's one super glossy brochure. Okay, here's another one. Wait, this is another State Department, Oregon of Emergency Management, they did their own too. Well, why? Do we not all have the same mission message? Isn't that what this is all about? Continuity of messaging? Mm. So I ask you, multiple state departments, federal agencies, and by the way, you'll notice FEMA's not here. Mm-hmm. I challenge you. I haven't looked in the last 2 months. I challenge you to go look at the FEMA website and encourage FEMA Region 10 from the Oregon state level. Why don't they have FEMA? Why don't they have tsunami information for my citizens to click to? We have ready.gov. You look at all the hurricanes, tornadoes, all that great, amazing stuff. Tsunami's not there. Why not? Why isn't the tsunami represented? Why does my citizens have to pay extra money to get the message out? And then when the tourism industry comes, they go to the Chamber of Commerce. Mm-hmm. Well, I want all these free brochures. Well, it costs money. That costs a lot of money that comes out of the local operational budget if we can't find a grant to pay for it. There aren't any more. Here's another example. The tsunami maps, the tsunami evacuation maps, they're beautiful. They're amazing. They are so beneficial. They are so expensive. Yes. Do you know how much these cost? We have our first community, the community of Seal Rock. They're not an incorporated community. They have no more maps. I have one Seal Rock map left in my county. It's laminated. Now, you can go with your smartphone, and you can look at the map online. However, if you want to put one in your car, or, for example, I want to give an entire set to the state troopers, Oregon Department of Transportation, workers that work in my county, and all of those other state agencies, which, by the way, they don't have these maps in their cars, how do I get them one? So do I have to pay for these through my operational budget? Do you know how expensive these are? They're over $3 a piece. And if you can't buy in giant bulk pricing, you're paying really big bucks. So I ask you, if what the entire mission is your personal individual resiliency, I don't even use the term preparedness anymore. I use personal resiliency because when I look at my citizens and I talk to them, I ask them, how do you maintain your personal resiliency? You have to be accountable to yourself. You have to be able to sustain yourself. Your government is only going to be able to do so much after a catastrophic event. But it's my job, as your government liaison, to give you the information about your hazards and how to prepare yourself. But it's costing us a fortune. You cannot tell me that two state agencies can't share this information. And the bigger point that I'm making is you're moving towards this terminology of resilience. Another point I'm going to make with the Oregon Health Authority, I know they're not in the room. My other job is, in Lincoln County, I'm also the Public Health Emergency Preparedness Coordinator. We're one of three counties in the entire state that said, wait a minute, preparedness and emergency management? Why would we have two separate divisions in two separate departments? That makes no sense. Other two counties had to merge those positions together for financial reasons. They couldn't afford to pay another person or the matching grant. In my county, we put them together and said, we will have one voice, one message, one program. So now when you go to the Oregon Health Authority and you look at their website, right now they're doing some amazing things on public outreach and tools and things you can download. I can reference to that. But then I go over to Oregon Emergency Management. I'm like, okay, well, let's go there too. Where do I direct my citizens? How many website locations do I need to send them to? Wouldn't it make sense if we had one state emergency management preparedness outreach website? Couldn't all that information be collected together in a library? Are we maximizing our dollars for the taxpayer on the right message? How do I order these? What's the best thing? And this isn't just tsunami and earthquake. This is floods. This is the whole thing. It's a package deal. And I believe in local control, local decisions, local education. But at a certain point, we're spending too much money with the messaging. It needs to be consolidated into that one word of resilience. Okay, moving on. So the other last piece about the tsunami maps. This is our only alternative to print off those public evacuation maps. You can do it, but the average experienced aged individual is not going to have the capacity to print this. The other thing is, I challenge you to read it. You cannot read this. You could not probably find your street name to evacuate yourself. So this is not a viable option. We need to go back and redo these maps to make them more user-friendly. And I have 12 maps in one county. For Lincoln County, there's 12 maps. That's very expensive. Okay, public safety facilities. Talked about the school districts getting them moved out of the inundation area. Same thing needs to be considered for public safety facilities. I have some pretty decent fire stations and a law enforcement police station in the city of Toledo that's sitting in the inundation area. They don't qualify for any grant funding. Those communities can't afford to move them. Obviously, schools are much higher priority because of the student populations. However, long-term, we need to figure out what are some financial incentives or grant opportunities to be able to move those public safety fire stations and law enforcement facilities out of those areas.
They don't qualify because they're in the inundation zone, or they don't qualify because there's not a category?
There's not a category. Okay. You can't ask for money to move a building at this point.
No, that's right. Not
right. Yeah. Maybe down the future. Okay. Mass notification. This is really a big thing for me. And I know that Deputy Director Stuckey is ready to tell you that, oh, Oregon Emergency Management is finally ready to start talking about it. But I'm going to push the envelope. Every citizen in the state of Oregon has the right to have their community have a mass notification system available to you. If you as a citizen can pick up a phone at any point and dial 911 to tell them you have an emergency and to get help, every citizen has the same right for 911 dispatch agency to do a reverse calling to a landline number or cell phone, because there's kind of two different features there, and be able to have that emergency information be directly communicated to you. The other reason why I bring this up is it leads into my next point. The EMPG funding, as was discussed here, is getting less and less and less. That's where my position is funded, but it's also where our outreach funds come from. And up until this year, we were utilizing our EMPG grant funds to help pay for our mass notification system for our county. Our funds were depleted to the percentage-wise down, and so we had no other option other than to take it out of our EMPG grant fund, and now we have to use operational funds in order to pay for that. We pay over $21,000 a year for my county alone for a population of just over 46,000. But what I challenge OEM, and I hope that they're actually able to accomplish the concept that they may be moving forward with, if all of these different cities and counties are paying for a mass notification system, I'm paying for 21,000, you're paying for 20. At a certain point, we have to say, have we really evaluated that we shouldn't have a statewide mass notification system across the board, even if it means it's a co-op basis? So I get the best price possible for the citizens for an emergency service that they should have access to. So mass notification, my number one thing, we've got to make that available to everyone in the state. Dagami, another question about, oh, yes, sir.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
So what I'm hearing you say is that instead of multiple faces, multiple agencies, a singular message across, and where possible, a simpler system of getting information out. Is that right?
Yes.
So could you convey to the PSAP community that 47 is a lot?
47 PSAP agencies?
47 PSAPs. How many? 43. Sorry, 43 is a lot.
So what you're saying, reduce the number of PSAP agencies.
State police can do what it does with two.
I neither agree or disagree with that statement.
I'm simply saying I'm with you. I think we have lots of different faces.
Here's the life safety issue. I'm telling you, we're going to start running into this issue if we don't have a statewide system. For example, my primary dispatch systems come through WVCC in Salem. The city of Salem and Lincoln County both have a mass notification system. Those dispatchers are required to have two logons for two separate notification systems, even though they're both Everbridge. However, now we're talking life safety because now we've built in another barricade to reach emergency information to that citizen. Which system do they log into? A mistake could be made. Seriously, it's pushing information out. One system across the state, it's time. There's other states that already have it. It's time for us to do that. Okay. Dagami landslide. I had the benefit of going to the OEM preparedness workshop last spring, second year in a row. It was a fabulous conference. It really was. We took so much away from that, and it's very beneficial, and I'm sure they're going to continue it, and I really encourage that. One of the presentations was the Department of Geology and Minerals and Industries. So they did this really great presentation. They talked about this landslide data that they have available, but they don't have the money to run the data analysis. Well, why not? Isn't that to help us? Isn't that what this is all about, our hazards and threats? You have data sitting there, but you don't have the money to do the analysis to tell us where our landslide threats are. So one example they gave in this geographical area, traditionally through their science, they can see there's 1,300 active landslides. After they overlaid this new data through LIDAR mapping, they saw over 8,000 landslides in the same geographical area. So her point being, oh, you just want us to move up the hill? Are you sure you're not going to be coming right back down the same hill that you just moved up? So data is there. Have we really done our due diligence to make information available so at the local level? Because we can't hire all these scientists and all this geologists. That's what that department is for. So do they need more benefit to finish what their project is that they need to accomplish? The last piece is the hotel industry and tsunami evacuation routes. At some point, we have to make it a requirement that the tourism industry and hotels where people, bed and breakfast, vacation rentals, just like the fire plan that they're required to post, they should be required that if they're in the inundation area, they put this map, how do you get out of here, and where's your tsunami assembly area to get out? It should be a requirement. Now, many of them are doing it on a volunteer basis, but it should be a building requirement across the board. And that's all I have. But I'll leave all this great stuff as an example.
Thank you. Any questions?
Sure. We thought we could get our list. We could get our list.
Yeah, no. Earlier, we thought we were making great progress and had a lot of things and plans, and then you come up, and you let, and that was incredible. No, and I appreciate you doing that, because that's the whole thing of how...
I gave you the short...
One sense, we think we're making some progress, and then we understand all these other pieces, and certainly are people being notified, having the pieces of information, a piece of information that they can obtain quickly, all of that's critical if we're going to respond, or the resiliency from people, so I appreciate your... bringing those up. And
if you're ever looking for a volunteer to be an emergency management liaison to your committee, I would so volunteer.
Okay, thank you. Thank you all for taking the time to come here. One more. Sheriff?
Chairman, can I offer one more quick thing?
Sure.
One of the last group that was up here, they asked was, so what would we need? I only realize this as I'm pricing equipment, is that earthquake retrofitting or earthquake engineering doubles the price for capital facilities. So if we're going to look at how we make rural communities resilient, there's going to have to be some assistance put out to help us with that. I mean, we can save our money and try to get there, but it's going to be a lot longer now that we do to be resilient in many fronts if there's not assistance there.
So the assistance you're talking about is capital money,
It'd be grant assistance for capital projects that are designed to be resilient, have a clear focus on resiliency. A 3.5 million gallon tank costs about $3 million. Earthquake engineered costs about $6 million. So,
Good point. Thank you. We have one more person, Tom Bergen, sheriff. Still here? Nope. I don't blame you. Okay. And again, thank you all. It just, you know, it helps point up there's a lot of moving parts here in that. And again, one of the attempts that I hope this committee that we do, we start picking those pieces that we can start making some incremental. But certainly the conversation about notification and resources available was a critical one about, because that's something we should be able to work on quickly and make sure that there's some continuity to that. So we've heard some discussions about emergency management, and Mr. David Stuckey is here. And we didn't bring you here to respond to all of that.
First question is why?
That's right. So now we can.
Well, Chair Lively, members of the committee, I'm Dave Stuckey, the Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department and former Director of the Office of Emergency Management. And with me today is
Chair Lively, members of the committee, I'm Sean McCormick. I'm the Director of Financial Administration for the Military Department and the former Mitigation and Recovery Section Manager inside the Office of Emergency Management.
Thank you for your patience.
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, fantastic discussion today. Loved being in the back of the room. Loved being able to follow Jenny Damaris. Spent a great many years working with her. Lincoln County, I think, is absolutely fortunate to have her as a emergency manager. The first thing I'd like to highlight is that we have our new Adjutant General, and I know it's not EMPG,
but
I would be remiss if I didn't say that the governor has selected a new Adjutant General. It's Brigadier General Mike Stinsel, 31-year veteran of the Oregon Air National Guard. He's a DSG, a drill status guardsman. He's an M-Day, a traditional guard soldier, or excuse me, airman. That's going to cost me.
Airman.
Airman. That will cost.
That's going to cost you.
A, it starts the alphabet. A.
Absolutely. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And so a longtime veteran, fighter pilot, F-4s, F-15s. And so he started on Friday, the 25th. As you know, General Hokanson left for Northern Command. He was promoted to with his third star and then went off to Northern Command on 16 August. And so actually General Hokanson was the first and probably the last three-star Adjutant General we'll have. And he was Adjutant General for about 10 hours before he moved out and General Stinsel came in as the acting. And so we're happy to have him. He's on board. He will certainly make time available here in the near future, Chair Lively, and for the members of this committee to come forward and present in front of you and also have office calls.
And we look forward to that.
So you betcha. You betcha. Well, Chair Lively, we were asked to discuss EMPG, and there was a lot of discussion today about a lot of fantastic topics. And there is a couple of themes that we certainly want to, that you've picked up. I'm sure you did. Commissioner Labhart talked about it right at the beginning about the part of collaboration, and we're all in it together. And we heard about no state edicts, but make certain that everyone is able to ensure that they're working together. Jenny Damaris is wrapping all that up with, let's talk about some coordination in that regard. You know, Commissioner Hyde, longtime experienced emergency manager, fantastic, intelligent man that has dealt with this and the issues of emergency management, how to get communities back on their feet post Vernonia and other disasters, multiple disasters. And so, you know, it's a fantastic discussion. I would just like to boil this down to the Emergency Management Performance Grant. This is what you asked us to come forward to talk about today. And really, it's a people's grant money. It is generally speaking, it's not generally, it is 50% of a person's salary at the county level and the city level. We have roughly about 98 individuals across this state that are paid for out of emergency management. And 50% means if they're a full-time employee by the county, then that's 50, half of that salary. If they're a half-time employee, then it's obviously a 0.25 in terms of EMPG components. That grant has actually held fairly steady as it applies to the federal government. It's gone up just a little bit at about $5.2 million. Last year is about $100,000 more than last year, I believe. It's the only grant that's actually stayed steady or gone up just a little bit, and is largely because of what counties and cities and the emergency manager like Jenny Damaris have gone back and lobbied the federal government and said, don't kill that grant. Our other grants, the Homeland Security grant, has gone down significantly over the years. And so, like most grants in emergency management, and we are a Grants R Us type of agency at OEM, we make certain that it's collaborative. And so we have a process in which we divvy out this money, but it's all based upon a process that the locals help us craft. There's no way in heck we're going to sit there and make some pen and ink changes across the board without being able to make certain that the locals are a part of it. And so they help create the formula. And it's based upon population, city, county, certain criteria. But this formula is not artsy. It's scientific in terms of trying to make it even. So the only real big changes that we had in EMPG the last couple of years was in 2013. That's when we created the formula. Mm-hmm. And then also in 2013, the reason it did go down just a little bit was because we thinned the soup. We thinned the soup because the tribes were not allowed to have EMPG. And we made a statutory change in our laws that allowed for the 9 federally recognized tribes to also be eligible for EMPG. And so, yes, it did thin the soup a little bit. But in terms of being able to level the playing field, we wanted to make certain that all jurisdictions had that capability. So in regards to the slide, you'll see that it says 3 tribes. Well, it's a voluntary opt-in. If you don't have 50% to match, and it's a hard match, it is not a soft match. And if it's a soft match, then the FEMA is going to come back and say, we're going to take it back. And so we got to. There's some very important rules. And you know when the federal government divvies out money that they divvy it out with rules. And as Commissioner Labhart mentioned up front, there's some plans, there's some training components, there's some things that you got to do in order to earn this money. And so that's really the net result. EMPG is important. We want to see it go up. We want to make certain that we can help staff the people. Everything that we do in emergency management always starts with people. It's not the stuff, the everything else, or the brochures, and even though our brochures are the best, it's not about brochures. It's about people, and it's about making certain that the people are on the ground at the city, county level, and the tribe in order to make certain that they can help develop the plans and the process to bring everyone together in order to make our state more resilient. And that's really it from a closed standpoint. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
So this information we have as far as the dollar amounts, this is the amount of the grant that has to be matched. So I'll pick on Lane County. It says $197,269. So they need to come up with $197,269.
That is correct, Chair Lively.
And I think I heard you also say that this has been pretty much steady state from a standpoint of the amount of funds available.
From a federal government, we've been given about $5 million or so every year.
But so that doesn't allow for cost increases and things. I
mean, it has not.
Right.
No, Chair Lively.
So.
Question?
Yes.
So I see that on the list there are 5 cities, only 5 cities, that received an allocation. So is that because others choose not to apply, or how does it just seems like we've got a lot of cities in this state.
Mr. Chair, Representative Peluso, it was based upon criteria again that the community came together on, and the decision was made cities that have 85,000 or more in people.
Yep.
And so we have 242 cities. There are many cities that still get this money through the county.
Through the county.
Okay.
So, but direct EMPG cities, there are only 5, and it's based upon an 85,000 or more figure. It's still a population-based component. We still want to make certain that we can get to as many people as possible.
You bet.
And that's the criteria developed collaboratively.
Makes a lot of sense. Thank you.
Sure. Yes, ma'am.
Rather than counting, so is every county a participant?
34
counties.
34 counties participate. It's an opt-in.
So it goes back to the match requirement and an opt-in.
Generally speaking, yes. Yes, sir, Chair Lively.
And there's no, from a state standpoint, so there's no state funds mixed in. It's either county or the federal funds.
Chair Lively, there are state funds mixed in. Because OEM also gets EMPG dollars.
Oh, okay.
And so the staff, some of the staff, not all the staff at OEM also receive EMPG dollars, and they're matched with certain requirements. And it's either other funds or it's general fund. I would like to offer, and this pamphlet is being handed out, and I think it's already gone forward, or committee administrator is going to put it forward. If you go to page 25 on this at some point in time, you'll see the state-by-state comparison of EMPG distribution. So this is the amount of dollars that the state distributes to the locals.
Okay.
And Oregon distributes more money to the locals than any other state in our nation.
Yep.
In fact, we distribute this past year at 17%. The next closest states are Maine and Ohio at 32%. And so why is that? Mm-hmm. Well, generally speaking, a lot of it has to do with the wanting to give the money out to the locals because they're the ones that need it. But then also there's a general fund shortfall, generally speaking, in OEM that helps also manage that number. But OEM gives out a lot of money to the locals for this.
So that's up to the state. So that's interesting when you see that big variance. So that's up to the states about, there's no requirement from the federal standpoint about distribution of those funds.
No. Chair Lively, other grants do that. Mm-hmm. Some of you may be familiar with the Homeland Security Grant Program. That 80% is mandated by the federal government, by Department of Homeland Security to go out to locals. This not. No state gives out more EMPG dollars to their locals than Oregon.
What other questions do the members have? Good information based on the prior conversations we were having about the importance of these grants, too.
Sure.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I'll stand aside for the Marines.
I think so. That's right.
Boy, I could go a couple miles on that one.
Yeah.
Okay. So we can see. So we've been at this a couple hours. Do we want to stick with it, or do we want to?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
He's been waiting patiently,
I know he
so
has.
We should be patient with
and this,
him.
Mr. Director, this all goes back partly to I saw you on television in my area, and that's what updated my interest in these community conversations, and not suggesting there wasn't anything appropriate about it, but I said, so what are these community conversations?
Excellent. And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I am Cameron Smith, the director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and also want to note for the record that as a Marine, it is hard to have to follow the Army and Colonel Stuckey. But we have about a 55-minute presentation here.
Oh, good luck with that is all I can say.
Why does this committee not love our veterans and our military families? But the reason that we get out of bed as veteran advocates is our veterans. And finally, out of our 70th anniversary expo benefit that we had in June during session, finally capturing the images and the stories of our veterans. This is a Korean War era veteran. Stephen Wright, he joined the Air Force at age 17. His mother signed the paperwork, and immediately that same day, he was on a plane shipping out to basic training. We have our advisory committee's annual report that we handed out both to the legislature and the governor. Also have some copies here. We are very proud of what we have accomplished over the last year. But it is those stories and the data points of our veterans and the impact on our veterans and the stories of our veterans that help sell this mission, both for us as an agency and with our partners. Out of our three main lines of that claims and counseling, the home loans and the skilled nursing, as those three core component business items or programs for the ODVA, almost 9,000 new power of attorneys on those claims, helping draw down that $1.3 billion of cold hard cash, plus $2.5 billion of federal VA total dollars. Had $60 million in home loans, low interest, below market rate home loans, highest level of production since 1998, and now just this month, the one-year anniversary of that Lebanon Veterans Home, the second facility, and still won the Gold Award for that original facility in the Dalles. All of those details out of our program, key performance measures in the back of our report, beyond all those stories of our veterans. A big thank you from all of us in the veterans community out of what we accomplished in the 2015 long session, which feels like a heartbeat ago with already all back in the building. But we invested in our veteran services system statewide. That extra $1 million going down to the county veteran service offices was essential. The doubling of our training capacity at the state level to make sure they are not just the best resourced, but also the best trained. As we build that system for all veterans, 320,000 plus, four generations across five major wars, also making some specific targeted investments in underserved veterans. We had the Women Veterans Bill signed ceremonially, I believe just yesterday, Monday, by the governor.
Yep.
But the cheer that went up from our women veterans, very honest and heartfelt discussion and debate on that last day of session in terms of are we fragmenting our veterans community at the same time as we are building that system. We hear that loud and clearly. We will invest in that system as a state, but also how the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs implements any of the more specific, whether the women, the LGBT, the aging veterans, the rural transportation grant, the suicide and mental health component. For some of the more underserved populations, not trying to create new front doors and specific access points for specific groups of our veterans, because a veteran is a veteran, but also recognizing that there are unique needs across our veterans population. I would highlight two other policy bills, the OHA data sharing, getting more of that outreach, also now able to keep the veterans' information private. And we also got representative payee as part of our conservatorship program and have had a huge infusion of folks, vulnerable veterans who can't take care of their finances, having the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs help manage their finances as a representative payee, but a significant increase that we'll see some changes also moving forward to February. Priority enrollment for community colleges and universities, the Disabled Veteran-Owned Business Certification Program to get preference in public contracting to disabled veteran-owned businesses, plus the honor and recognition bills, whether the POW, MIA flag, flying. I believe it triggers to January 1st, but wherever we fly that U.S. flag and the state of Oregon flag, the highway signs, which doesn't feel like an outcome-driven outcome or policy initiative, but has huge effects on the spirit and goodwill for Korean War veterans, Military Order of the Purple Heart, and our other veterans community. While we are thankful for that investment and we are proud of our work over the last year and everything that we have done with our partners in that annual report, we know we are skimming the surface of the opportunity for our veterans and military families. We took this summer after session to barnstorm across the state, attending county fairs, meeting with veterans groups, county VSOs, legislators in their district, visiting prisons, community colleges, skilled nursing facilities. And we didn't hear often a lot of complaints about our core programs. They could always be more effective, more efficient, and we will continue to drive that. Often a lot of challenges on the federal VA healthcare front and the rollout of community care, vice care within the VA. But there's also a disconnect, not always knowing what those resources are and what is available to our veterans and their families. And when we look forward, how do we truly infuse, I mean, it is the voices of our veterans. This is Serena Criswell, a fellow Marine, works at ODOT with DMV. How do we, well beyond state agencies, how do we pull in the veterans community voices into this building in a very powerful way? Not just to shape outcomes for veterans, but also move the needle on the policy areas and the issue areas that you all are interested in, that we hear around across the state, from healthcare to mental health to employment to economic opportunity, small business support, housing. Not necessarily always core programs at ODVA, but certainly our leadership, advocacy, and partnership that will be able to convene that center of gravity, not unlike what we see out of emergency management, given the breadth that they face. But happy to take any questions.
Any questions?
I have a comment.
Absolutely.
So I just want to express my thanks in a variety of ways, or give a shout out to Director McCormick and Director Stuckey and Director Smith, but also to this panel for how welcomed I was to this, not being a veteran, being a rookie. I tell you, to have that woman vets bill signed was a rush and a half. And I truly believe that our goal is to work toward it not being a gender identity, but truly a veteran's identity, but we have work to do to get there, and we need to, again, to respect the differences and be sure everybody's welcome. But with the conversations that I had with those women vets who had not even felt welcome to come into their capital, and to have the turnout we had, and again, that spontaneous reaction, that is probably one of the greatest gifts I have received in so many ways. And again, I just thank this group. I wish everybody was here. I might have to say this again when we all are back. But it has just been an incredible experience. And I think I told you on day one when we did our little introductions, my dad was a World War II vet. And so I do a lot of this in honor of him. And so I also thank you for the opportunity to just think about my dad.
Thank you for bringing forward and sticking with it to do it. Because as you know, there was a lot of priority things and
right.
Some got didn't. But I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Escobar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to share with people that we, this past week at the Veterans Administration Cemetery in Eagle Point, we interred three World War I veterans. We also buried six
World War II Korean veterans, 2 Vietnam veterans, 2 peacetime veterans, and 3 spouses. These people were left on a shelf in a funeral home. We now have an organization that goes into funeral homes, looks who has never been claimed, because these people were never claimed, and finds out if they're veterans. And if they're veterans, then we turn it over to our veteran administration, and we get them the proper burial and put them finally to rest. But it's sad enough to be a POW or an MIA, but to be lost in your own country is just unforgivable. So I was privileged to take part in that. The other thing is I met Master Chief Spark today, and Director Smith was in the office, and the chief and I were talking, and he started laughing, and he said, "Do you guys realize you're speaking Navy?" Evidently, we speak a different language.
Marines have to use coloring books.
So. Oh, no.
Oh, I didn't I'm sorry, say Director that, Cameron. Smith.
It wasn't me this time.
Yes, absolutely. I'd also want to say a shout-out to Director Smith and his team.
Great team.
We had Polk County Fair, which is not the biggest fair in the universe, but it's the best.
Oh.
We had a challenging environment for ODVA to be there. We did not expect it to be challenging, but having ODVA there to get the word out, to have direct outreach, we're going to try to do that again and build upon the program, and it was just a really good message for the county, so we appreciate you doing that.
Remember Director Smith, he was part of the Air Force, so he wasn't really in the military.
Jealousy.
I did have an experience dealing with veterans that was pointed out to me the differences in our country. I was in Tennessee, and we didn't go back there. We went back there to trace my wife's ancestors back over 200 years in pioneer cemeteries, but in going to those cemeteries, one of the things that struck me was the War of 1812, the Civil War, and the veterans, and some of those places have done a great job of restoring. I mean, they knew where they're at, but in some cases the record was lost, but they've restored. And so walking through those cemeteries and tracing from Vietnam, Second World War, Civil War, the War of 1812, they were all there.
Yeah.
I mean, it was fascinating to think about and to see. I mean, puts it in quite a context of how long veterans, I mean, the importance to this country from the very beginning, but the long road it's been. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as part of our 70th anniversary, we were looking back to those founding days, June 1945, and there were Spanish-American War veterans on that first advisory committee.
Really?
And, you know, the World War II veterans were the recently returned Iraq and Afghanistan of today. Mm-hmm. But that is that brotherhood and sisterhood that crosses all generations of veterans, urban, rural, men, women, every ethnicity and creed. And I do not believe we have truly tapped into that to truly move the needle forward on a huge host of issues facing the state of Oregon. And we feel that pivot point in this 70th anniversary year. What are some very meaningful but targeted course corrections to put us on a path, just like those building codes do for emergency management, very similar efforts to really drive forward to honor and serve our veterans. And appreciate all of your support. We'll be looking both for our own individual policy options and budget fixes in February, but much more largely looking at what are the broader recommendations that we can roll out, not just for February, but to infuse governor's budget and partner efforts well into the future.
We look forward to those conversations. Thank you very much. Anything else? Thank you, members, for being here the third day of our legislature. We'll be back in November, if not before. Any other questions?
Thank you.
Great. Thank you, sir.
We'll adjourn.
Great. Thank you, sir.